Good morning. On today's programme, Turkey's problem with femicide and how Cubans are leaving the island in large numbers due to food shortages and rolling blackouts. But first, we go to Somalia in the Horn of Africa. It's a country in the grips of its worst drought in four decades. Children are dying, animals perish from hunger and thirst. More than a million people have left in search of help. Along the route they take, deaths are largely going uncounted, and the situation worsens by the day, as Sally Hayden reports.
I'm counting graves. I'm in a displacement camp in Baidoa, Somalia, amid the worst drought in 40 years. Millions of people are going hungry and hundreds of thousands are said to be experiencing famine-like conditions. It is unclear how many people have already died. That's what brought me here. In front of me are 101 graves. They were all children under the age of 8, locals say, and they were buried in the last 2 months. Two children were buried the previous day, and two more the day before that. Their graves are simple, small mounds, topped with rings of stone. Abshir Isaac Abdi's two-year-old son Adam was among them. Along with the lack of food, Adam contracted measles, which is particularly dangerous for malnourished children whose immunity is low. He didn't receive any medication, Abdi said. There's no health facility. There's no means of transport. Abdi couldn't afford the nearly €5 it would have cost to take his son to hospital on a motorbike. Before the drought, Abdi said, he owned 10 cows and 50 goats. They all died, and his means of livelihood was eliminated. Now we just survive, he said. We'd prefer to get any basic needs for humans. Somalia, a Horn of African country of roughly 17 million people, has always been affected by droughts, but climate scientists say they are getting more frequent. Somalia is one of the most vulnerable countries in the world to climate change, yet its emissions are extremely low. Ireland produces more than 50 times the emissions of Somalia, despite having around one-third of the population. This was something that Somalia's first ever climate change minister, Khadija Mohamed Al-Makhzoomi, was keen to emphasise when I met her at her home in Mogadishu. Five consecutive rainy seasons have failed in Somalia, and a sixth is expected to. Pastoralists are watching their livestock die from thirst and hunger. Last April, on my last visit to southwest Somalia, I saw dozens of goat carcasses rotting on the ground where they had perished. More than 1 million people had been displaced by drought by August last year. Yet the situation has not officially been called a famine, which aid workers say might result in a new rush of donations and a renewed sense of urgency. The last time there was a famine here, in 2011, an estimated 250,000 people are thought to have died, about half of them before the declaration actually happened. Aid workers worry that the lack of a famine declaration is also making it easier for government officials to ignore the fact that Somalis are already dying from a lack of food. That's why I ended up counting graves. But I was limited by security concerns, including the advice given to foreigners to travel in bulletproof vehicles with an armed escort, and not to stay in most locations for more than half an hour because of the risk of kidnap. Al-Qaeda-aligned group Al-Shabaab control large swathes of territory in Somalia, and they are currently fighting against both the government and African Union forces. In total, I was told about 169 children who recently died, and counted 115 graves across three camps for displaced people. Among them were two of Muslima Made's four children, an 8-year-old and a 1-year-old. We need to improve food security, she said. Even the common cold can kill you when somebody is hungry. Hunger makes children weak. Declaring a famine requires technical definitions to be met. At least 20% of households must face extreme food shortages, 30% must be acutely malnourished, and two adults or four children out of 10,000 must be dying each day of starvation or related causes. I made repeated attempts to talk to someone involved in assessing whether Somalia is experiencing famine, and eventually I got on the phone with Daniel Mulla, the Chief Somalia Technical Advisor at the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. He said their methods of gathering data are robust, and that assessments actually show that famine mortality thresholds for the numbers of children dying have been reached among displaced people in Mogadishu and Baidoa, but other thresholds have not been met. The unfortunate situation that's happening now is that there is too much emphasis on whether there is famine or not, he said. The level of suffering is beyond imagination. The scale and severity of suffering, the level of mortality is unacceptably high. For World Report, this is Sally Hayden in Somalia.
Next we go to Turkey, where the murder of a woman by a man against whom she had secured a restraining order has ignited concerns about Turkey's failure to protect women, as Jasper Mortimer reports now from Ankara.
Last year, a woman in Ankara called Gulsum Kuyar was threatened by her estranged husband. She was divorcing him, as he hadn't held a job for years, and she found it hard enough to support their two children on her wage as a cleaning lady. His threat was so convincing that Gulsum asked the police to serve him with a restraining order. 6 days later, her husband ambushed her at her workplace. He stabbed her 9 times and ran off. She died. The next day, the restraining order was issued. 9 days ago, a court convicted the husband of murder and imposed the maximum sentence, 30 years in prison. But for thinking Turks, Gulsum's case encapsulates the government's failure to protect women. And the hard truth is that even if the authorities had issued the restraining order quickly, it may not have saved her. Last year, angry men killed no fewer than 334 women in Turkey, and 23 of the killers had been served with restraining orders. In one case, a woman had complained to the police about a man 35 times before he killed her. Femicide has become a public issue, and it's a contested one. The figures I've just given come from a group called We Will Stop Femicide Platform. The group accuses the police of failing to investigate female deaths properly. It also accuses judges of being too lenient in sentencing men convicted of attacking women. Several of these issues came together in the case of Shula Chet. A university student, Shula was persuaded by two men in their 30s to go to an office tower in Ankara for a late night drink. She needed a job, and she'd worked for one of the men before. In the office, she was raped. It seems Shula had the courage to indicate she would report the rape, because she was then beaten up. Finally, unconscious or dead, we don't know, she was thrown out the window, which was 20 stories high. The two men were charged with rape, but nothing more. Women's groups, the platform among them, mounted a steady campaign of demonstrations, which the press publicized. The chief prosecutor dismissed the prosecutor assigned to Shula's case and appointed another. Finally, in December 2018, 7 months after Shula died, the two men were charged with murder. A year later, they were convicted of murder and rape. But then leniency intervened. The judges shortened the sentences of both men. Article 62.2 of the Penal Code allows a reduction of sentence for good behavior in court. So the principal accused got 24 years for murdering Shula instead of 30. A lawyer involved in both Shula and Gulsum's cases, Advocate Onur Tatar, explained that Gulsum's killer did not benefit from 62.2 because traditionally a husband gets the maximum sentence for killing his wife. Liberal Turks think the quirks of this system have no place in modern society. If throwing a person out of a 20th floor window does not deserve the maximum penalty, then the system is defective. Advocate Tato thinks public opinion is changing, that people want judges to base their sentencing not on behavior in court, but on the crime itself and on the defendant's criminal record. A puzzling factor is the silence of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who has vast influence in Turkey. Erdogan says a woman's place is in the home, and every woman should have 3 children. But he has not condemned the high number of femicides. The man who runs what is arguably the most reliable polling company in Turkey, Özer Sencer of Metropol, says this has to do with upheaval in Erdogan's support base. More and more women are becoming educated, pursuing careers and leading independent lives. Conservative men find this deeply disturbing, Sencer says. Erdogan wants to stay out of this debate. This is Jasper Mortimer for World Report in Ankara.
Finally, we go to Cuba. January is the height of the tourist season there, and the streets of Havana are busy with people returning after lockdown, bringing with them euros and dollars. But while visitors flock to the island nation, Cubans are leaving in previously unseen numbers, an exodus brought about by food shortages, rolling blackouts and economic instability. A situation many say is worse than Cuban's so-called special period in the early 1990s, when Cuba was on the brink of economic collapse after the fall of the Soviet Union. From Havana, Owen O'Sullivan reports.
Walk through the streets of Havana's old town and you will be greeted by the smell of cigars, sound of salsa music and a potent rum cocktail at every corner. But if you ask for basic foods such as bread, milk or cheese, you will quickly discover that there is none, or at least it is very hard to come by. Not all is as it seems in Cuba. The communist state has for decades been at the behest of an American embargo and suffered economic alienation in the Caribbean region. It is no stranger to issues of importation. However, now Cuba faces food and medicine shortages at a previously unseen level. Locals say it is worse than the so-called special period of the 90s, where Cuba was on the brink of economic collapse. Many store shelves are empty. Restaurant menus change day by day depending on what ingredients are available. Locals struggle to find necessities for their households, such as soap, shampoo, and toilet paper. But if you venture to the tourist areas, there is a much better chance of finding what you are looking for, because tourists have what the Cuban government wants. Tourism is one of the very few ways external currencies can enter the country. This foreign currency is vital for the Cuban government to pay for much-needed fuel and food bought on the international market, a market Cuba has very limited access to and where its own currency, the Cuban peso, is not recognized. Cuba's recent hardships are acutely felt by its people, but Cubans who have access to tourist currencies, such as euros and dollars, have a small respite by being able to spend these currencies in government-run MLC stores, also known as dollar stores. These MLC stores, which act as a midpoint for the Cuban government to collect foreign currencies, are often well stocked with goods and electronics otherwise inaccessible to Cuban people. But the MLC stores may be doing more harm than good. These stores are a palpable example of inequality, says Cuban-based economist David Pejon, speaking to Reuters. They're a source of discontent. For Cubans who do not have access to foreign currencies, mainly because they do not work in tourism, long queues now await at sparsely stocked government-subsidized stores where ration books, called libretas, are still necessary. One Havana-based sociologist, who asked not to be named, told this reporter, "People have to wait all day at the pharmacy only to find that the medication they need is sold out, with police often standing by the queues to keep the order." The government is aware of the social imbalance these stores are creating. In February last year, the Cuban economy minister, Alejandro Gil, on state-run television, asked for understanding, saying that the MLC stores are a lifeline, also saying that the government expected 23% of MLC stores' sales to help subsidize 77% of sales in pesos. But many Cubans have decided to take matters into their own hands, instead turning to a thriving black market. Miguel, a local business owner in Santa Clara, explains that these markets are often conducted in plain sight of the authorities. They would rather people have access to things like toilet paper, which the government cannot provide, than close it down and run the risk of protests, he said. These black markets have increased dramatically since 2018, when Cubans gained access to the internet on their phones. Apps such as WhatsApp and Telegram can have thousands of users in encrypted group chats, arranging trades from across the country, allowing people to reach much further than before. But even with this high-functioning shadow economy, shortages remain. The government blames COVID-19 and increased sanctions by the Trump administration. But locals suggest that the situation has been mismanaged by the government. Through decisions such as dropping Cuba's second currency, the convertible Cuban peso, on January 1, 2021, in the height of COVID-19. This economic turmoil, along with increased issues of food security, as well as rolling blackouts, has led to one of the biggest exoduses in Cuban history. Many tried to reach America by raft. Nearly 3,000 Cubans were picked up by the US Coast Guard in the last 2 months of 2022 alone, with the majority of people now attempting to travel by land to the States, opting to fly to destinations such as Venezuela and travel up through Central America. 220,000 Cubans reached the US border in 2022, reports the New York Times, a 12-fold increase on 2020. A small easing of the situation came earlier this month when the US Embassy in Havana announced, after a 5-year hiatus, it will again start issuing visas to Cubans, 20,000 a year. But while there is no long-term solution in sight, the migration looks to continue. Meanwhile, ingenuity and adaptability will be necessary for those who remain. For World Report in Cuba, I'm Ono Sullivan.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. If you want to listen back to the programme, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.